The History Show with Maz Duncan.
Good evening. On this St. Patrick's weekend, we're focusing on the history of an integral part of our culture, dancing. In the decades after independence, where and how we danced was of huge concern to the Gaelic League, the state, and the Catholic Church.
There is one agency which Satan has set up that does incalculably more harm than all the others. It deserves to be called after his name, for he seems to preside at some of the dark rites enacted there. We have in mind the rural dance hall, conducted with no sort of responsible supervision.
What was to emerge gives us a fascinating insight into the attitudes to sex, sensuality, and sin in Irish society. There are two seminal events that must be addressed in any history of Irish dance. One is the very first Ceilidh, that was in 1897, while the other took place almost 100 years later, an extraordinary performance that transformed Irish dancing into a truly worldwide phenomenon. Lorcan Clancy puts these two events into a cultural context in this short history of modern Irish dance.
The Gaelic League was founded in 1893 with the aim of preserving Irish culture and promoting a sense of national identity. At first, the primary focus of the group was the Irish language and literature, but an interest in traditional music and dance was also encouraged. Most branches of the Gaelic League held dance classes. It was the London branch that organised the league's first Ceilidh. It took place on the 30th of October 1897 at Bloomsbury Hall, not far from King's Cross Station. This first Ceilidh included an eclectic mix of dances. As well as traditional step dancing, there were waltzes and polkas set to Irish airs. The Ceilidh also saw the introduction of group or figure dancing, in which lines of men and women faced each other to perform a double jig. The mixture of old and new dance steps on show at the event caused some controversy. Some Gaelic League members thought the new steps were too far removed from native Irish dancing. The word Ceilidh originally meant a social gathering with music and storytelling that didn't necessarily include dance. In the early years of the 20th century, the word gradually took on the meaning we know today, as the dance element of these events became more and more prominent. The question of what constitutes traditional Irish dancing continued to be a source of debate. In 1930, the Gaelic League established the Irish Dancing Commission, an authority that would govern and regulate Irish dancing affairs. The commission drew up rules and established a register of qualified dance teachers and adjudicators. Throughout the 1920s and 30s, cultural activists argued against a new foreign influence on Ireland's dance halls, jazz. The Catholic Church was also opposed to jazz, regarding the provocative dancing of the late-night jazz halls as an incitement to sexual immorality. In 1935, the government bowed to public pressure and introduced the Public Dance Halls Act. This made it a finable offence to hold a dance without first getting a licence from the district court. The clergy successfully applied for dancing licences. Many parish halls were built all over the country, where dances would be supervised by priests. The Dance Halls Act made it virtually impossible to hold a dance without the sanction of church and state. It was meant to resist the supposed moral depravity of the jazz halls and protect Ireland's dance tradition from foreign influences. Ironically, some believe that the act actually marked the end of some cultural traditions, as it made events like crossroads dances effectively illegal. From the 1930s on, the popularity of Irish dancing ebbed and flowed, alternating between periods of declining interest and revival.
Before we get down to the real business of the evening, the voting, I would like to introduce to you an exciting and uniquely Irish performance, specially commissioned for tonight's show.
Almost 100 years after the first Ceilidh in London, the popularity of Irish dance was given an unprecedented boost following the Interval Act at the 1994 Eurovision Song Contest.
A full-bodied orchestral dance piece involving traditional Irish dancers.
Ladies and gentlemen, River Dance.
Riverdance placed this cultural tradition on an international stage, fueling the popularity of Irish dancing all over the world.
Indeed it did. I'm joined by Barbara O'Connor, author of the recently published The Irish Dancing, Cultural Politics and Identities, 1900 to 2000. Also with me are Deirdre Mulrooney, author of Irish Moves, an Illustrated History of Dance and Physical Theatre in Ireland, and Jermaine Ferreter, author of Sin, Sex and Society in Modern Ireland. You're all very welcome. That piece that we just heard from Lorcan Clancy was bookended by two dance events a century apart. The first Irish Ceilidh in London in 1897, and the first performance of Riverdance in Dublin in 1994. But Deirdre, go back well beyond that first Ceilidh in 1897. Do we know when did we start dancing?
Well, there's very little written evidence of this, but we presume that Irish people always danced, albeit in a ritual function or at various community events and stuff. We don't have any written evidence. And indeed, there is no native word for dance in Irish. The words that we use, dowsa and rinka, are both loan words. Catherine Foley referred to the fact that dancing was so integral to Irish life that there was therefore no need for a word for it.
Right. So therefore, Barbara, the notion that the Normans, for example, brought dancing to Ireland, we can forget about that. That's not true.
Yeah, I think I agree with Deirdre there that, you know, nearly every known culture dances. But I think what's important to say, and again, the things about rinka and dowsa were they were coming from French and English, and it was because linguistically there was no word. But what functions as dance is different from culture to culture and over periods of time. And I think maybe that's what is at issue, you know, that there is dance in every culture, but what is talked about as dance, separated out from other activities, could vary. So.
The famine was a watershed, Jeremy, in many, many different ways. Many things in Irish society would change utterly.
The famine affects everything. And there's no doubt that it had serious psychological consequences, as well as having a huge impact on the economy and society and on demographics. It also has an impact, I think, on relationships between the sexes, in the sense that there is a certain exaltation of the idea of celibacy. You know, people marrying young is being discouraged. And you can see, you know, 20 or 30 years after the famine, that a new attitude is having quite an impact on marriage rates and on people's attitude to procreation and marrying young and inheriting land. I mean, they're all linked up. You can't, you know, look at any of these in isolation. But certainly you can begin to detect something of an alliance, I think, between quite a conservative landowning class whose expectations have risen in the aftermath of the famine. Remember, there are those who do okay out of the famine in the sense that there, you know, there are less people for the land to be divided amongst. They do become quite conservative socially. They do build certain alliances with the Catholic Church. And that does feed in to what sometimes we refer to as a more puritanical attitude. And of course, the effects of that kind of mindset last well into the next century. And what you're really dealing with by the time of the launch of the Gaelic League, and then at a later stage, the early 20th century, are very robust debates about what constitutes Irish culture, what constitutes Irish dance, what constitutes acceptable codes of behaviour, how can we define ourselves by opposition to other cultures and other practices and other moves. So it gets down to that level, and some of the most vigorous debates within the Gaelic League are actually about what is an acceptable form of Irish dance.
And why does the Gaelic League, Barbara, which we think of as primarily being concerned with the language revival, the revival of the Irish language, why does it turn its attention to dance at all?
Well, initially it was interested in all kinds of, you know, revivals of Irish culture, including language, sport, dance, music, folkways and so on. But there's a number of reasons, I think, probably why dance became more important. Patrick Pearse is interesting because he talks early on in the after the foundation of the Liga in the early 1900s about the fact that people, to get people to come to language classes, for instance, they need more entertainment. Very often language classes and dances, you would have a dance after the language class. Later on, after the foundation of the state, the Gaelic League has less influence on language policy, which has now been taken over actually by the organs of the state. And therefore, dance was actually one of the few projects that they could now turn their attention to because of these kinds of reasons.
OK, 1897, the first Cayley. Why was it held in London rather than somewhere in Ireland?
London was the capital, as it were, because of the empire. The guy who ran the first Cayley, his name was Fionnán McCullum. And he worked in the India office. He was a civil servant in London. And he was also the secretary of the Gaelic League in London. So I think it's interesting the kinds of people who were in the Gaelic League, indeed, promoting very middle class. There was a very big interest because you had a lot of middle class Irish working in London for the British Civil Service. And they were very interested in nationalist culture. And there was another reason as well, I think, which again relates to empire. And it was that Queen Victoria herself was very much, it was a great fashion at the time for Celticism. And of course, she was very interested in Scottish culture. And they had the first Cayleys of Scottish, the first Cayleys were held in London. And indeed, the Irish, the Gaelic League then thought these were very successful. And so again, they too thought, well, we will revive, you know,
so
London.
The first Cayleys were actually Scottish.
Yes, that's right, in London at that time. But again, very much related to the kind of fashion for Celticism that, you know, Queen Victoria herself championed.
Dance becomes an issue. It becomes a moral issue. It becomes an issue for discussion. Why is it so important that Catholic bishops become involved in talking about it?
The Catholic Church was rowing in with the state in the invention of Ireland. And it wasn't just Irish minds, but also inventing an Irish body. So, you know, what would an Irish body consist of, and how might it be different from another nationality, for example? And the Irish body was to be one that was straight until the knees and only moved below the knees. So this was something that the church was very much in favour of.
Well, it's absolutely fascinating to look at the language that they used in these church pronouncements, the sheer violence of the language that was used. And there's a common theme running through all of these, and it's fear. Fear of the modern, fear of the foreign, fear of the body, fear of overt displays of sexuality. There was a Lenten address given in Dublin's inner city by Father Michael Garrahy, who was a well-known Jesuit in the inner city in 1922. And the title of it is The Collapse of Chastity. And then in 1924, the Bishop's Lenten Pastoral refers to the existence of many abuses. And those abuses are listed. And it's not just about dance. It's also about evil and immoral literature. It's about the motor car. It's about strikes. It's about lockouts. It's about theatre. So there's a whole melting pot, and they throw everything into it. But the interesting thing about their language is it is so strong and so foreboding and so doom-laden. And it makes you think about two things. It makes you think about the opportunities that they saw there to reassert their authority after a period of great upheaval in Irish society. But it also makes you think that they were not happy with the way ordinary people were living their lives and spending their leisure time. You know, the thunderous denunciations are repeated again and again, which would suggest that perhaps people were not being as obedient as they wished them to be. And even when you go on to things like the, you know, the concern about jazz, you know, Cardinal MacRory at the time would have admitted that he didn't know anything about jazz.
But he still didn't like it.
But he had been told that it was suggestive and was dangerous. So they try and mobilise people around the idea of a need to resist, again, you know, those outside influences. But there's a great fear of the body and the body being on display and, you know, how the sexes are physically interacting with each other.
There's an interest. Well, again, I wanted to just quote here from Dr. Doherty that you mentioned, his Lenten Pastoral of 1924, if I may, just to give you the idea of the language that we've been talking about. The dances indulged in were not the clean, healthy, national Irish dances. They were, on the contrary, importations from the vilest dens of London, Paris and New York, direct and unmistakable incitements to evil thought and evil desires. And I think maybe that says
and
it all.
Of, one of their favourite words was degenerate.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. The degenerate dance halls. But I think women, I think it's very interesting because I think, you know, the body itself, you know, was a problem. But I think women's bodies were particularly problematic. And I think this was really coming through from the 1920s with modern women. On the one hand, they were vulnerable, but on the other hand, they were dangerous because their bodies were very sexualized and particularly the modern woman.
Right. And
so
this,
it was both of those.
This is being, or finding its ultimate expression, Deirdre, in foreign dances, whatever foreign dances are. But what are we talking about? What are the foreign dances? Are we talking exclusively about jazz here?
No, well, actually, in 1930 as well, the Commission Larenka Gaelga brought about a ban of all foreign dances. And the foreign dances, you know, would have been anything foreign, like foxtrots.
Waltzes. Was a waltz a foreign dance?
Mm-hmm. As far as, you know, the Gaelic League was concerned, yes, it was. And I mean, this is really contradictory because, you know, previous to this, in Irish society had always embraced foreign influences, and especially in dance as well, you know, where we see in the set dancing and that the quadrilles, the French patterns, and, you know, the French dancing masters of old. So this was actually something foreign to native Irish people, you know, not to embrace foreign movement and foreign
and trying
dancing.
To uphold the idea that the Irish women are more chaste than women anywhere else in the world, mm-hmm. and that the Irish generally are purer than any other race. And you'll see constant references to that. Now, it's important to point out, not everybody took this seriously. Mm. You can see this in the 1930s, where there are attempts to legislate for some of these issues, successfully in terms of the Dance Halls Act, in terms of bringing in the legislation, though it's honoured more in the breach, I think, than the promise. Mm. And you also have the Carrigan Committee of the early 1930s, which originally started out as an investigation in relation to juvenile prostitution and issues like that, but contains an awful lot of commentary on the supposed degeneracy of the Irish. The idea, again, that there has been a collapse in standards. And Ono Duffy, the Garda Commissioner, would have been very vocal about this. Now, it's not published because the material that is in that report is deemed to be completely at odds with, you know, Irish society's version of itself or the image that they want to project. But there were also those within the government and within the Department of Justice that thought an awful lot of the evidence that they had received was completely exaggerated. And it goes back to this question of what people were actually doing outside of this language of stricture and of denunciation. John McGarren wrote very well about this, I think, you know, at a later stage when he wrote about the visiting redemptorists, you know, who used to go to the individual parishes and threaten all sorts and, you know, denounce the fornication and the vulgarities and the excessive drinking. And, you know, all the parishioners would promise that they'd do better and they'd have their retreat for a week or two. And then the redemptorists would pitch their tent in another village and they'd just revert to their preferred ways and remain pretty fundamentally anarchic in their everyday behaviour. So, you know, McGarren makes the point that they were appreciated like comic characters, like horror novels, that they were evaluated as performers in how they were screaming at their parishioners.
Tell us about the 1935 Public Dance Halls Act. What was that piece of legislation all about?
That was about restricting the licences for public dances, so that you essentially had to get the support of the clergy and the local justices. The idea was that it would prevent the spread or the proliferation of unlicensed dances. Mm.
And house dances.
And house dances.
Kitchen dances.
I mean, they were the traditions, you know, that people would gather in localities or in individual houses in the parish. So it's, you know, it's trying to put them on a more formal footing and make that spontaneity less possible.
Yeah. But also I think it's interesting because they licensed dances and they also wanted to see properly supervised dances.
Yeah.
But the licensing is interesting because to get a license, the character of the person was taken into account, as well as their financial circumstances. Now, again, I'm not sure, you know, how that played out in reality. But I think it played out in such a way that only very respectable or what were seen to be pillars of the community got licenses for certain places at certain times. And again, I think, you know, you can see the role of the church here, because you got you didn't get a license, for instance, for a late dance on a Saturday night because, you know, people had to get up for Mass on a Sunday morning. So again, you could see the kind of alliance in a way.
There's between a class dimension to it.
Between cultural leaders that were of a particular class and the church.
And the late night thing is crucial to all of this because when we refer to late night, we mean late night. Back then, people danced all night. People would be coming home at 6 o'clock in the morning, having literally danced all night. Now, they mightn't be doing much else beyond the dancing, but this was part of the issue that people moved from dance to dance to dance. So they had a concern, of course, about not being able to supervise that level of socialising.
There weren't that many prosecutions.
No, there weren't. And it's very difficult to enforce. But it's also like the pubs. I mean, there were times when pubs by law had to be shut. That didn't mean there weren't people drinking inside of them. You know, so, I mean, people come up with their own ways around this. And I mean, you can see even at a much later stage where by the early 1960s, there's 2000 licensed dance halls in Ireland, which is one for every 1,500 of the population. It's a hell of a lot. And they were looking for more and more of them. And the district justices were commenting on this at the time.
OK, there were 2,000 licensed dance halls. There were also unapproved and unlicensed dance halls.
Which were much better crack.
I'm sure they were. They continued, though, to be denounced from the local pulpit, as we'll hear now from Josephine Biogli, whose grandfather turned his fish salting factory in West Kerry, in the West Early Gaeltacht, into a dance hall.
My father, Brandon and Bugley, and his two brothers, Michal and Seamus, had a dance hall in the Cork Arena Gaeltacht in the 50s and 60s. And my father always referred to it as an shed. Agus, will tú dul siar in shed anocht? You'd ask your friends. Or a fella might ask you, are you going back to the shed tonight? And of course, if a fella asked you, if you were going to the shed tonight, your day was made, or your night was made. But as I said, it was originally a shed. My grandfather, their father, Michal Begley, was an enterprising businessman. He ran the shed as a fish salting factory, I think, in the 20s and the 30s. But he must have decided at one stage that there was more money in dancing than in salting mackerel. And he made the transition from mackerel to people in the 40s. And the people of West Kerry, being full of the joys of life, in spite of lean times and clerical attempts at domination, they took to the shed and the dancing, and a whole new life and means of earning extra lolly for my grandfather fell into my grandfather's lap. Needless to say, of course, this turn of events did not go unnoticed by the local clergy, who, of course, had their own parish hall. The parish priest at the time, known as Father Tom, was an extraordinary character. He was loved and feared in equal terms. He condemned the shed in Moriach as a place of unspeakable behaviour. Began parochtisha lond of vasterty. Egan Hallison here. This parish will produce any amount of illegal offspring, as he said. But my grandfather took no notice. And the shed or Hall na Marie flourished in spite, or maybe because of, poor old Father Tom's pronouncements.
Dermot, the backdrop, of course, to all these decades were the Magdalen laundries, clerical sexual abuse, horrific incidences of incest. Would you attribute any of this to our acquired attitude to our bodies, or is that too much of a stretch? Would these things have happened anyway?
No, it's not too much of a stretch. There's a complete preoccupation with visibility and mobility. And, you know, those who were identified as being transgressors or as being a threat to purity and morality, they're hidden. You know, they need to be made invisible. And, you know, that is also related to women who are deemed, you know, to be too physical or too sexual. You know, people ended up in Magdalen laundries for a variety of different reasons, and poverty was probably the most important. But there are those who are deemed to be a threat and need to be taken out of circulation because of their sexuality. So there's no doubt that they're linked. All of those questions are linked. What's also important, I think, and you heard it there in relation to West Kerry, is the attitude of the local clergy. You often seem to arrive at cases where there were those who cooperated with the clergy or there were those who fought against the clergy. So there's a lot of those battles going on. But there's also the question of the options that people had in relation to socialisation. I couldn't help thinking there of William Trevor's great story, The Ballroom of Romance, you know, from the early 1970s. And, you know, some of the language that the men are using in that story about the women is overtly sexual, and there's an awful sexual frustration in it. But then you also have Bridie, who's talking about not liking being kissed by these dirty men with the sweat coming down the sides of their faces. And she says, I don't like the way you kiss me. I don't like the way you bite my tongue when you kiss me. I don't like the way you take a swig of a bottle when you're having another go at me. And yet she's there because there aren't really any other options if you're in any search for any kind of ballroom of romance. So there's a certain tragedy, I suppose you could say, to that social situation, and the backdrop there is the 1950s and the lack of options that were available to young men and young women. But you get this image of the men kind of descending from the hills, the dirty men descending from the hills.
Okay, back after this break with what happened when our emigrants brought Irish dancing abroad. Welcome back to our special programme exploring a century of Irish dance and society. We've heard about Irish dancing at home, but what happened when it went abroad? Did it thrive or was it abandoned in the newly adopted homes of the Irish emigrants? Rona Tarrant brings us this report from New York.
We're standing on the corner of Baxter Street and Grand Street.
In Manhattan's Chinatown, Larry Kerwin is giving me some perspective on exactly where we are.
And if you were to face down south into Chinatown, this was one of the streets that ran into the Five Points.
In 2014, this is still an immigrant neighbourhood, just like it was in the 1800s. The only difference is that now when you look around, you'll see things like colourful souvenir shops. But back then...
Oh, you've seen a lot of brothels, and a lot of bars, saloon.
This was the Five Points, New York's filthiest, poorest, most crime-ridden neighbourhood. But it was also where music and dance flourished.
Irish people were playing fiddles in the bands and African Americans were playing percussion and banjos.
It was a melting pot of culture and Irish dance was at the heart of it.
When the Irish came here, there was a dance craze in the country. So everybody had steps, everybody danced.
To really understand Irish dance in the States, you'd have to look here, but it wasn't necessarily where it started.
You could trace Irish dancing at least to the 1700s.
That's April Mastin of Stony Brook University.
By the 1790s, jig dancing is considered an American dance form.
The Irish had mixed their free-flowing dance into an emergent American culture.
The arms are usually out to the sides, but they're sometimes held down by the sides, but always relaxed.
It was mixed with African steps and performed in saloons and on stage as a type of sport, with champion dancers challenging each other all over the country. The most famous was Master Juba.
But those champion steps, he was usually performing opposite a woman. And so the two of them were competing, and then if he would win, he would, you know, jump on the bar and call for a drink.
Eventually, one strand of Irish and African steps became something known as tap. But by the early 1900s, society changed and the Irish had stopped mixing so freely with African Americans. This brought a new era of Irish dance.
At one point, there were close to 76 dance halls in Manhattan alone.
That's Mick Maloney of NYU.
In the dance halls, there would have been a collision between the old form of set dancing, which people would have brought them from Ireland, and the newly created dance forms of the Gaelic League.
And while traditional music lay dormant in Ireland, the dance halls thrived in the States. They played jigs and reels mixed with some modern dances.
Like the foxtrot, the waltz, the one-step, the two-step.
New immigrants would be brought on stage and introduced to their new community. It was central to both a new and old identity.
The dance hall represented a bridge between Ireland and America. You retained your Irishness by going to an Irish dance hall. But you asserted your Americanness and being able to choose your life's partner on your own without the interference of your parents. This was a revolutionary change, and it happened in the dance hall.
And while the dance hall might have seemed old-fashioned back home, the immigrants continued a culture of music and dance for a new generation of Irish Americans.
They had a very positive attitude to Ireland, and they wanted their children to grow up with a sense of Irishness. They danced and they played music, and they encouraged their children to do the same thing.
Rona Rona Tarrant there with that report from New York. My studio guests are Barbara O'Connor, Deirdre Mulrooney and Dermot Ferrisher. We tend to associate Irish dancing schools and Irish dancing competitions at this stage with the USA, the taut arms, the controlled waist, the rigid upper body, which appears to be unique to Irish dancing. Was that dreamed up? Or was that the way traditionally Irish people danced? How did that emerge?
Well, it's very interesting, actually. You know, like, for example, down in Kerry in Sheemshatira, they had the Munich style, which continued unbroken, which was a very free-flowing style. But what happened with the Cumasúin Laoghaire Gaeilge is that they brought in the competition dancing and the Feisne. And the first Feisne was in 1898, actually, in Macroom in Cork. So from there, you know, it began to develop how to regulate this Irish dancing and how to judge it and measure it. So, you know, you had to have straight shoulders and arms, you know, more or less attached to your body, and this eventually developed into people sewing their arms onto the
body. Apparently
bodice.
That's now been banned only yes. recently, relatively recently.
Yes, and yeah. as it happens, I
it's
have
regarded
this...
as cheating though, is it?
That, no, it's here from the website, irishdancing.org. It goes, dancers, important notice, World Championships 2014. Any dancer found using artificial carriage aids which prevent full lateral and vertical movement of arms will be disqualified.
Right, so Lance Armstrong is not going to be taking up Irish dancing anytime soon by the sound
and that's
of
only
that.
Happening this year.
And,
so
I mean, what about the hair and the costumes and all of that? When did that come in? When did that become, it would appear, almost as important as the dancing itself? And was that an American import?
Yeah, well, the first, it's interesting because what's really huge now are the Worlds, the Irish World Dancing Championships. And the first Irish World Dancing Championship happened in 1970 up in Parnell Square in Colossia and Wirra. So it was really since then that this whole kind of really crass commercial element came in. So you have these kind of hand-embroidered costumes, you know, with Cú Chulainn racing across them, and they cost around, you know, 5,000 euros each. So imagine, you know, for the mothers, and then if they're coming from abroad, they're bringing the whole family back. And then the, you know, the ringlets, the mascara, the fake tan, like the whole work. So it really kind of turned into something very, very over the top.
Yeah, we spent a year in Boston 5 or 6 years ago, and the kids were at an age where they were learning to do the Irish dancing, could not get over the contrast between Dublin and Boston. Now, Boston was like a circus, you know, and all of the expense and the, you know, the focus on appearance, and it was actually quite obscene.
Meanwhile, back home, the friction between traditional values and foreign influences continued. In 1934, the original ballroom of romance, The Rainbow, opened in Glenfarne, County Leitrim. The man behind it was returned emigrant John McGivern, who in this clip recalls what he told patrons that first night.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, here we are. You're all landed now, and you remember what I said in all the papers and what you're supposed to do. We're going to start the first romantic interlude of the night. Any man that can get a partner, get one. But while there's any girl sitting around and a man to be standing around, he must go over and get the girls on the floor. Now, first of all, you have to shake hands with your partner. In the middle of the dance, then you have to kiss your partner. And the third part of it now, you have to, if you have any notion at all of making a date, better still, if you're thinking of getting engaged, better still again, if you're thinking of popping the question, this is the time to do it.
You could pack a lot into a night.
You certainly yeah. could, couldn't you? A bit risque for the time, Barbara. That was a year before the Dance Halls Act was passed. But it survived. How come it survived?
I think the 1930s saw a lot of building of dance halls. And it saw the building of both the parish halls, very often under the aegis of the local clergy or local community, both. And then the more commercial dance halls. And I think it's very interesting. John McGivern's Ballroom of Romance is probably one of the first of those kinds of public dance halls, commercial, private dance halls to be built.
How did the clergy respond to all of this?
Well, it's very interesting because there was, again, the old redemption adventurous missionary, was there, and he was very critical of the dance hall. So McGivern invited him and said, come and see how I run the dance hall, which he did. And he went, and according to McGivern, he was delighted with how properly supervised it was, how great it was. And he said, I wish there were more men in Ireland like you.
Is he didn't what have to use his stick.
Words. He did not. No.
To separate.
He did not.
Okay, so ballroom dancing becomes hugely popular with young people, as we'll hear now from Percy Lovegrove. It was a great outlet during the difficult years of the emergency.
At the beginning of World War II, Ireland entered a state of emergency. Despite the circumstances, Dublin people took up ballroom dancing in their droves. Percy Lovegrove was one of many who first laced up his dancing shoes as the rest of Europe went to war.
Well, I was working in the Great Northern Railway in Amin Street, the old GNR, and there was a very active social club there. I was on the committee. One of the highlights of the whole year in the social club's activities was the dress dance. That's really where I started, serious dancing. But prior to that, I'd had lessons from a lady called Doreen Cuthbert, and I enjoyed my series of lessons with her.
Ballroom dancing was more than just a hobby. It was a social experience. Percy's favourite dances were those which gave him the opportunity for intimacy with his partner.
I loved the slow foxtrot and I loved the slow waltz. I also loved the tango. That's a very romantic dance. You put your arms around your partner and she put her hand on your shoulder and you worked very much in unison. That was one of the attractions, of course, that you could actually be holding your partner while dancing and you were able to convey what steps you were going to take merely through movements of your hands and your body, and she was able to follow you. I think it was all a question of meeting the opposite sex.
Ballroom had plenty of styles, but Percy told me he has a particular favourite.
I think the slow waltz is my favourite. It's a lovely, slow, romantic dance with not too intricate movements. And to have your partner, and if she was your girlfriend, all the better, in your arms for that, it was wonderful.
Percy was far from alone in taking up dancing.
It was a very popular pastime. Ballroom dancing was very big in Dublin, and nearly every club, social organisation and workplace had its own ballroom session and would have an annual dance and maybe hops, what we called hops, kind of 8 p.m. to midnight, several times a year. It was very big business.
Dancing also offered a break from the harder parts of life during the emergency.
The emergency, the war started in 1939, and I would have been at the time in my late teens. And it suited me very well to have this outlet because times were difficult.
Ultimately, though, for Percy, it was all about the romance of dance. He and his dance instructor, Doreen Cuthbert, soon became more than just teacher and student.
We had no intention when it all started off that that's the way it would end up. But after 6 or 8 months, I was reasonably well-founded in ballroom, and she asked me to partner her in some demonstrations, which we did, various dances around the city. And it grew from that, and we kept company together. And Doreen, this particular year, 1943, created a ballet and choreographed Weber's Invitation to the Waltz. I was very impressed with that. And on the Saturday night when the show finished, I proposed to her, asked her to marry me. And she said, ask me again tomorrow. Which I did. The answer was yes.
Sure, what else could she say? He's down in his 90s. Percy Lovegrove talking there to James Keating about his love of dancing and indeed finding the love of his life. Dermot, with the spread of ballroom dancing around the country, did attitudes to women begin to change? Were they still regarded as a threat to the social order at this point?
You don't get the same kind of language or rhetoric that we were talking about in the 1920s and the 1930s. What you do still get are very traditional conceptions of what a woman's role is, and traditional gender divisions. You know, women are going to ballrooms to find romance. Mm. You know, the Catholic journals of the 1950s are full of talk about women in the cinema. The women have unreasonable expectations because they're going to the cinema and they're seeing this unavailable promise or utopia, and that's what they're chasing after. It's quite an insult, obviously to the intelligence of women. I think you could say that women's attitudes to themselves started to change in the 1940s and the 1950s. We know, for example, that there were more women emigrating from Ireland than there were men in the late 1940s. Sean O'Fallon, the writer, interviewed one such woman who had left Ireland in the late 1940s, and he asked her why she had left. And her response was very succinct and very telling. She said, "I saw what my mother went through. Not for me, thanks." So certainly in relation to the idea of them being such a fundamental threat, I don't think that's as strong. But there are still, of course, quite traditional attitudes that last.
I'm going to talk to Deirdre in a moment about an extraordinary woman. You've already mentioned her, Irina Brady. She was a German refugee. She set up Ireland's first modern dance school in Harcourt Street in 1939. She hosted dance classes for children in her studio by day and slept in one of its alcoves by night. One of her students, Anne Walsh, remembers her class as well, as we hear now in this report from Louise Denver.
Her appearance, it would always be in the leopard skin coat that she wore continually and the black beret, and she had black hair and was very striking. It was a large room with a skylight, and at one end there was a grand piano and there were artists, and it was an interesting building as such.
39 Harcourt Street, Dublin, was the home of Irina Brady's studio. Without her, it's said that modern dance simply wouldn't have happened in Dublin during the 1940s.
At the time, it was Irish dancing and Greek dancing as well. But that was very much, in those days, legs only, you know, and the arms, you kept your body rigid. Whereas in modern ballet, you used your whole body, and in particular your arms. So it was much freer.
Anne Walsh started dancing with Irina in the 40s in her Irish School of Dance Art studio. It was cutting edge in a Dublin where classical ballet was often favoured.
As a child, when I went to the classes, I accepted them. To me, it wasn't at all strange. But I think outside the actual school of dance, a lot of people didn't accept it as such.
Irina was one of a number of Bohemian refugees who left mainland Europe at the time of World War II.
The poets and the painters and arty society that she veered towards, and they all loved modern dance.
While it was different and exciting, there was a sense of dislike and unease for her ideas in both the dance world and Irish society.
People were a little bit, oh, what's that? You know, same way as like with modern art. Oh, I don't like a man having three eyes sort of thing in modern art. You know, the people that she mixed with were all very arty as such. And outside that circle, I don't know whether she was accepted in the general humdrum. With people talking to me as I grew up, they just preferred the classical ballet. And if you said you did modern ballet, there was a sort of pause, and then they said, oh, you don't wear shoes, do you? Everybody came back to, you don't wear shoes, which was ridiculous, really. Because life was pretty strict then, and anything that wasn't completely conventional wasn't accepted readily.
Although many people rejected Irina's style of dance, there were some who embraced it.
Even when Irina taught in a number of convents, they enjoyed the movement and realised that it was good for the girls, for the posture and for their general well-being as such.
And for a number of those who took part in class, a certain dress code was deemed appropriate. Some children wore socks and others long tunics. But there was one thing that was particularly concerning at the time, and that was the second position, where the feet were spread apart.
When you were doing the five positions, you had to go from first to third. They wouldn't let you do second because your legs would be apart.
Louise Denver. Gateways Denver, talking there to Anne Walsh, a one-time student at Irina Brady's dance school. For more about that problematic second position, let's hear this piece from the memoir of Jacqueline Robinson, a former teacher of Irina Brady's modern dance.
I cannot resist telling of an anecdote concerning one of my first teaching jobs in a Brigidine convent. For my first class, I wore a long fluid skirt, which was a customary garment for dancing at the time. The class went very well, with one of the sisters attending. Afterwards, I was summoned by the Mother Superior. "Miss Robinson, I hear that you lifted your skirt, revealing your legs, which furthermore were in a wide stance." We were doing second position pliés. "No question of your doing that here." "What should I wear the following week? In order not to have to lift my skirt, I wore a short one, a tunic. Would this be considered decent?" Before giving the class, I had to appear before an areopagus of sisters. They looked shocked, and it was pronounced that there could be no exhibiting bare legs under any conditions. So, what was I to do? "Give your class in your coat and skirt," said Mother Superior. Which I did, and for the whole term, at the end of which, the bishop declared that there were to be no more dancing classes of that type at the convent. However, during those weeks, secretly, I did help a charming young sister to stage a play on the life of St. Patrick.
Deirdre, Irina Brady was obviously before her time. How long did she last in Ireland?
Well, she arrived in 1939 and, you know, she made a great go of it. I mean, she had shows on at the Abbey Theatre. She collaborated with Austin Clarke. She collaborated with Liam O'Leary, the founder of the Irish film industry, who filmed an outdoor performance in the poet John Betjeman's residence in Clondalkin. And, you know, she had chosen the Mansion House. And she also spread this theory of a holistic modern dance. And as we're talking about being comfortable in your body all across Ireland, but eventually she gave up despite her best efforts in 1951. And what nobody realised was that her father had actually been a priest.
Stunned looks all around.
He actually...
That's not that unusual, is it?
He actually had been the dean and bursar of St. Patrick's Boys' School in Cavan. I don't know if you might be familiar
yes,
with it.
Yes, I'm actually a past pupil of said, so my astonishment is even greater. Let's move on to the 1960s. Jeremy, the Irish show bands at this stage had burst onto the scene. They were sending them home sweating, yeah, as it were. At this stage, has the church completely given up making pronouncements about dens of iniquity, or had people simply stopped
listening?
No, it
hasn't. I mean, I've been to the archive of John Charles McQuaid from the 1960s, and it's quite clear that he's trying to resist the tide unsuccessfully. You know, he's near in the last phase of his episcopate. He's concerned about television. He's concerned about the dance halls. He's concerned about publications and women's magazines. It's quite clear that he's not going to be successful in the way that he was in the 1940s and the 1950s. But I would say this, and it goes back to what we were talking about earlier on as well. For all the talk of liberalisation, social liberalisation, you know, the great fear is still an unplanned pregnancy. And, you know, even in the 1960s, there's still a huge stigma attached to the idea of the fallen woman. And one searches in vain for the fallen men in the history of Irish sexuality and the history of Irish dance and the history of Irish dress. But, you know, that is something that is still very, very strong and does still create a lot of fear. You're still dealing with an era where contraception is illegal. So you've all that going on. So let's not exaggerate, I suppose, the great liberalisation, but certainly there was going to be no way that the Catholic Church could repeat what it had done in the 1920s and the 1930s. The Church seems to me to be following rather than leading in relation to social change.
OK, to finish, we'll fast forward to the 1990s. There were two great expressions, I think, of growing Irish confidence in the 1990s. One was Italia 90, if you're a soccer fan. The other was Riverdance 1994, Barbara. Its legacy is quite extraordinary. Irish dancing in America is now river dancing, isn't it?
That's right, yeah. Riverdance in 1994 was an extraordinary performance, but turning it into a show that was globalised, that was, you know, four different troupes all over Europe, Asia and the US and so on, it became boring because it's on daytime TV in Los Angeles and it's on the ferry from Finland to Sweden and it's all over and it's no longer fresh. It becomes boring. It's virtuoso, it's very good performance, but the meanings change, I think.
Yeah, maybe it was done to death. I mean, it's already entered the history books as being symptomatic of increased confidence and Ireland's growing success in economic terms, all of these various different theories that have been put forth. One of the things you could say is that it also emphasised a continuity and an endurance. The good dancer was always esteemed. You know, if you go back to all of that we've heard over the course of this programme in relation to the original dance halls and the ballrooms, good dancers were always esteemed. And people put a lot of effort into trying to become a good dancer. A lot of us in the younger generation never learned how to dance properly, and sometimes we're shocked when we saw our parents when we were old enough at maybe a wedding or something, and we'd say, oh my God, they know how to dance. we don't know how to dance. So, you know, people were also, I think, celebrating the skills that were a part of dancing and what Irish dancing, you know, could become. There was nothing, there was nothing wrong with that.
But it's also the production values, I think, you know, just to mention like a set by Robert Balla, a score by Bill Whelan, you know, the costumes by Joan Bergen, like it really was a really, really slick production, which is something we didn't necessarily associate with Irish dance.
Well, I was talking about the critical, the critiques of it, but equally, and again, I think it's important because it depends on where you're coming from, that there are different perspectives. And some people see it again as being a wonderful, you know, celebration of Irish culture on a global stage. And, you know, let a thousand flowers bloom, as it were, in relation to Riverdance.
We will leave our discussion. Discussion on the association of Ireland and dance. At the end of his life, apparently, the poet W.B. Yeats lamented having lived for 70 years and never having danced for joy, a regret which I'm sure this evening's guests don't have. Barbara O'Connor, Deirdre Mulrooney and Diarmaid Farrington, many thanks for joining us. And more information about this programme, together with details of our guests' books, are on our website. That's it from me, Miles Duncan, and producer Yeti Redmond for this week. Until the same time next week, goodbye and enjoy the parade tomorrow.